This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to Crimes and Consequences. I hope everybody had an amazing past week. I know I certainly didn't. And you didn't either, but I hope everybody else did.
How do you know?
I talk to you all the time.
Yes, that's true. You do.
The story is about domestic violence, which I know is a trigger, but it's very important to make people aware of this stuff. So just toughen up a little bit, because I just think it has a lot of value for society to understand how these things come about and what goes on in everybody's mind. So suck it up is what I'm trying to say in a nice way.
Well, I think, too, by talking about it more, it makes people more comfortable talking about it. Like, besides, if me and you talk about it, other people will talk about it. And that way, if they're in a situation where maybe they're in a domestic violence situation, they'll be more apt to talk about it.
Perfectly said. That being said, before I start, I want to ask everybody to hit the subscribe / follow button on whatever app you're listening to us on. And I'm ready.
Me too.
Well, let's do it. Have you ever been to Naples, Florida?
I think so, yes.
Well, it's one of the most wealthiest cities in the United States. Per capita, it has the second largest number of millionaires.
Ooh.
It caters to those who are used to the finer things in life, like manicured golf courses, luxury cars, high-end stores, and pristine white sand beaches. But on September 19th in 2009, a cloud of unimaginable violence and darkness shrouded the city. It was a crime described as the worst of the worst. According to local sheriffs, quote, that in no certain terms, this was the most horrific and violent event this community has ever experienced. And this story is so heartbreaking. I'm not going to lie. I cried while writing it up.
Did you?
I did.
Oh.
And I'm pretty close to dead inside.
I know. It's like the Grinch with the heart.
Mm-hmm. Here we go. 32-year-old Haitian immigrant Gerline Dia Damas was a hard worker who devoted her life to her five children. She wanted to make sure they got the best education possible. That was her top priority. She was one of those women that were just born to be a mom. I mean, I wouldn't say I was born to be a mom, but I'm okay at it. She was born for that role. During the school year, she would rise before the sun to prepare breakfast for her children and lunches for her oldest. She had to be to work by 5. So when I say she was up before the sun, I mean she was up before the sun. She did all of that, and then she went to her job.
Breakfast wasn't like a Pop-Tart?
No, that's more for our children. Grab a piece of pizza on the counter from last night.
And just get the leftovers.
Yes, exactly. Her three oldest children, Mitchak, I think I'm pronouncing it right. He was 9. 6-year-old Maven and 5-year-old Marvin, they attended the North Naples Osceola Elementary School, where Mitchak was a 3rd grader, Maven was a 1st grader, and Marvin had just started kindergarten. These little boys were amazing children. I mean, they learned from the example their mother set to be respectful, kind, and caring. Mitch Sack would often go to Maven's classroom when school ended and just ask the teacher if there was anything he could do to help his little brother out.
Oh, that is so sweet.
It is. I mean, he was described as a really sweet kid. Gerline worked hard to be an involved mom and to be active with her boys in their school. She was also a dependable employee at Publix, where she worked full-time for over 10 years. Since Gerline was a little girl in Haiti, she dreamed of being a wife and a mother and raising a family to take care of. The one man that made this dream come true was the same man that would one day destroy it.
Dun, dun, dun.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Gerline emigrated to Naples, Florida from Haiti with her younger brother in the 1990s, and not sure exactly when. An older brother and sister had already came to the United States a few years earlier, and they helped her assimilate to her new surroundings. Not long after, she met a man, also originally from Haiti. He was 21-year-old Misak Damas. Haiti is currently considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. I don't know if you knew that. I didn't know it.
I didn't.
I knew it was up there, but I didn't know that. Missak came to the United States at the age of 19 to be with his parents, who are already here. His childhood, I got to tell you a little bit about it, it's pretty interesting. He spent his early years in a small Haitian village, and he grew up during the last decade of the violent regime of Jean-Claude Duvalier, known as Baby Doc. Have you heard of Baby Doc?
I am embarrassed to say no.
Well, he just took over the succession of his father, who was Papa Doc.
Okay.
During the regime, a secret police force encouraged paranoia in the population, and there was a mass slaughter of people. Individuals were routinely assassinated in the streets. People who dissented from the government disappeared, and a climate of fear permeated the country. Both of Missak's parents were members of a secret police force, which was unusual. When Missak was 5, his father left the family to move to the United States. And as a result, his mother relocated the family to Port-au-Prince to live with members of both her family and Missak's father's family. And this is an interesting mix. The maternal side of Missak's family were practitioners of voodoo, while the paternal side of his family had converted to evangelical Christianity.
Oh boy, that's a mix.
That's quite a household.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about voodoo.
Okay.
And this is from the court record. So if it's wrong, then you guys can all take it up with the court, because this is how they describe voodoo. There are a series of spirits who are available for protection and guidance, and family members inherit these spirits. The spirits are interested in justice. So when a conflict is present, spiritual forces can be engaged to achieve justice. Further, individuals can use spiritual force to protect themselves and sometimes for aggressive purposes. There's an understanding in voodoo that an individual can throw a force onto others to attack them. And this force pushes those who are attacked to do things they otherwise would not have done. There's also the concept of sending the spirit of a recently deceased person to persecute and attack a person, so that person that's attacked self-destructs.
Oh boy.
Wastes away or dies.
Damn.
So basically, I could put a force on Tanya that just made you fuck up your whole life.
I know some people that that's happened to. I wonder if they had a force put on them.
They're probably just losers. When Missak was 10 years old, his mother moved to the United States, leaving him behind with his grandma and his uncles. And his uncles regularly beat him. They were his father's brothers. Missak came to the United States to live with his parents, and it was around 1995. When he came to Naples, he started attending the Evangelical Christian Church in the Haitian community of Naples. So let me tell you about Haitian evangelical Christians, because they believe in voodoo spirits.
Really?
They do. They think they are real. However, instead of being inherited family spirits that can help, Haitian evangelical Christians believe the spirits are demonic.
Uh-oh. Oh, shit.
You can see where the story's going already,
can't you? Oh, shit. Yes.
By that time, Missak's mother had converted from voodoo to evangelical Christianity. And she was, quote, very attuned to aggressive spiritual attacks. So the whole family, on both his mother and father's side, began to see life through an evangelical lens where the devil is always trying to attack the family, end quote. A little
Damn,
bit of paranoia
yeah.
going on there. He'd only been in the United States a couple years when he met Gerline, and the two instantly connected. However, as time went on, their relationship ended up being very tumultuous. It was plagued by Missak's temper and his propensity to beat Gerline.
Fuck her.
He also cheated on her. And some of the women he cheated on her with were married. In 2000, Gerline gave birth to Missak, the son. Maven was born in 2003, and Marvin followed in 2004. And I told you, Gerline was a natural mom. In June of 2005, she petitioned Collier County Circuit Court for a personal protection order. And in her petition, she alleged that Missak repeatedly beat her, sexually assaulted her, and stole their money. And of course, they granted that restraining order. And you know what that asshole did?
What?
He filed one against her.
Fuck him.
Accusing her of all these stupid things. Like, he's so worried about his own safety. But his got denied. Now, there's that familiar pattern of breaking up and then getting back together. And that continued for the couple. There were more restraining orders filed. And then in 2006, Megan was born. In 2007, the couple tied the knot in a church ceremony, which was attended by friends and family. Now, if you thought being married might possibly help their relationship, you would be wrong. Of course, Misak didn't change anything. He was still cheating on her. He was still beating her. And he was extremely jealous. And that happens a lot when you have someone that's the cheater.
Right.
That person assumes their partner's doing the same thing. But she wasn't. But he just couldn't get that out of his head.
She was busy with all them kids.
Exactly.
I mean, hello.
Hello. He would randomly show up at Publix to make sure she was really working and not with another man. He would check her phone records. He would check her texts. He was doing all the things that you would expect a domestic abuser to do. Although he's a horrible excuse for a husband, he did have one good quality. He was a hard worker and he was a dependable employee. Both Misak and Gerline had very strong work ethics. Misak supported his family by working at Miller's Ale House, and he was liked by the majority of his coworkers. If you thought she had a lot of kids, she gave birth to one more, her fifth.
Oh, bless her.
In 2008, it was a little baby girl named Morgan.
Aw.
I told you, she really wanted to be a mom. She got more than me.
Right. I know, and you got too many damn kids.
Thanks for that.
I love your children.
Her life was busy. Between caring for her children and working, she was just going nonstop. But she wouldn't trade it for the world. Every violent relationship has its breaking point. Gerline's occurred on January 2nd in 2009. That evening, Misak began arguing with her about her purported unfaithfulness. Get over it.
Right.
During the fight, they were in the kitchen, and Gerline is holding baby Morgan in her arms. That didn't stop Misak from punching her.
Oh, damn.
He accosted her, and during the struggle, baby Morgan fell onto the hard tile floor. Misak then prevented Gerline from grabbing her phone. She was scrambling for it, but he wouldn't let her have it. Eventually, he left the house, and Gerline was able to call the authorities. Morgan didn't end up sustaining any serious injuries, but Gerline knew that the abuse was taking a toll on her children. I mean, they were watching their mom getting beaten frequently. During one such incident, Misak, and he's about eight or nine, he sees his dad beating his mom, and he grabs a cell phone, and he runs into a room, and he tries to call 911, but his dad chased him and smacked him and took the phone away. After the incident in which Morgan was dropped, Misak was arrested, and he was charged with misdemeanor battery. He was given a bond, and he was ordered to have no contact with Gerline, and that was one of the conditions of his release. Can you guess what he did? He just would send her flowers every day.
Stop it.
He's wooing her.
Yes.
That's what they do, right? Mm-hmm. He's wooing her. He would use his house key to enter the house. And then once he was inside, he would apologize profusely to Gerline and the children, telling them how sorry he was and how much he's going to change.
Sure.
Gerline didn't want to hear the apologies, and she didn't want him to come into her house. The Department of Children and Families, DCF, they'd gotten involved because of what happened to baby Morgan. And she was really afraid that if they found out Misak was in the house, she might get her kids taken away.
Right, like endangering them.
Exactly. She called a locksmith and she got the locks changed. But is that going to stop him? No, it's not going to stop him. The more she pushed him away, the more obsessed he became with her. He would drive by after his shift around 3 a.m., just driving, looking at the house. Sometimes he would sit in his car for hours, just watching through the window. He'd see her get up in the morning. He'd watch her get ready for work.
What a psycho.
Oh, girl, you don't even know yet. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
If she saw him, she would call the police. But all they would do was just, you know, give him a stern warning. Stay away. He then began borrowing friends' cars so she wouldn't recognize him.
Damn.
He was consumed with thoughts of Girlen leaving him and taking the children. And one day he, quote, couldn't take it anymore. He broke a window while Girlen was home and he entered the house. He begged her, please, you know, please, 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 please take me back. She didn't call the police, but she did immediately move out and she took the kids with her to a new townhouse in North Naples. This townhouse is really nice because Naples is really nice. And I looked it up. It's a 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath townhouse. It's about 1,500 square feet. It's got a 2-car garage. It's in a really nice neighborhood. You can rent a similar unit for $5,000 a month.
That's all?
That's all. I need to work at Publix. I am doing something wrong with my life. Misak pleaded no contest to the battery charge and was placed on 12 months probation. Now, in the preceding months, Misak attended parenting classes, anger management classes at the David Lawrence Center, all in an effort to be able to see the children. He and Girlen also attempted family counseling, which was a part of his probation conditions. Do you want to hear a little bit of shit?
I do.
Misak said that the classes and the counseling were really bringing insight to him as to why he got so enraged.
Really?
Bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
A year after Morgan was accidentally dropped on the floor, the no contact order was subsequently lifted.
Really?
Been a year.
Yeah.
He completed all the things he was supposed to complete for the most part. Now, this is a little upsetting. Towards the end of March in 2009, Girlen agreed to let Misak move into the townhouse with her and their children. But she told him the romantic part of their relationship was over. She was going to divorce him. I mean, it was really difficult for her to take care of those 5 children, even with her support system in place, like her family and her friends there. She got 5 children and a job.
Right.
When he moved back in, she made it clear to him that she did not forgive him. That was something that was pointed out. She did not forgive him, and there would be a divorce. Her family strongly disapproved of him being there, and her mother voiced her opinion about it. She said that if Girlen continued to be with Misak, she would never speak to her again.
Wow.
Do you blame her?
No.
You got to get your daughter out of that situation, mm-hmm. Break that cycle somehow. It wasn't long after he moved into the townhouse that the honeymoon phase was over. Not that it was really a honeymoon phase for her, but his behavior, him being nice and, you know.
Oh, yeah, because he got what he wanted now.
Exactly. That's over and the arguments start. Girlen held her ground. She repeated her intentions of divorcing him. And then during one of their arguments, she said, my mom said she won't even speak to me if we get back together. He warned her, quote, baby, let me tell you something. If you ever say that again, I will kill your mom. I will kill you. And I will kill myself.
Wow.
End quote.
Oh, shit.
On Wednesday, September 16th, a DCF employee visited with Girlen at the house. During their conversation, she asked some advice on how to go about getting a divorce. When Misak later learned of this, he became paranoid. He was convinced, quote, they were setting me up for failure.
Really?
He was so pissed off and he felt such a betrayal that he just, his mind, that's all he could focus on. That night, Girlen told him she would continue to go to therapy classes with him per his probation conditions, family therapy. But once they were done, she was filing for divorce. He became psychotic and he hit her. He beat her. Instead of calling the police, she warned him if he ever touched her again, she would make sure that he spent the rest of his life in prison. Now, I want to point out that this is his version of how everything went down. Misak was plagued with jealousy, haunted by the thoughts of Girlen with another man. He stewed over the idea of murder-suicide. According to him, quote, that's when the devil started coming out of me. I was like, oh, why don't you just kill yourself? Kill her, then kill yourself, you know? Let your parents, whatever, take care of the kids. But then I was like, but I love the kids. And when I die, how am I going to know if they're okay? End quote. The next day, Girlene got the three older children off to school, and then she left her job at Publix. Since Misak worked in the evening, he stayed at home with the two younger girls, Megan and Morgan. Well, at least he was supposed to stay home with them, but he didn't. He was so convinced that Girlene was not at Publix, but someplace, you know, having a romantic rendezvous, I guess, at 6 in the morning or whatever.
Who's paying the bills? I mean, she obviously is working because she's making money.
Well, he left their 3-year-old and 19-month-old alone at the home.
Oh, damn.
And went to Publix. When Girlene saw him at work, she was so frightened that she went up to a store manager and asked the store manager to help her confront him. They threatened to call the police if he didn't leave. Misak told her, quote, "If you call the cops, they're going to arrest me. They're going to arrest you, too, because both of us left our kids at home alone. They're going to take the kids away from us. I know you love the kids, right?" End quote.
Oh, what a dirty bastard.
I hate when people use
children. I know, use their children.
Tanya and I practice divorce law, and we see that way too much.
Very sad, and it pisses me off.
This was enough to scare Girlene. I mean, that was her worst fears, having her kids taken away. And there was no protection order in place, I want to point out, so I don't really know what the cops would have done except maybe suggest that he leave.
Yeah.
Of course, Girlene immediately left work to go to the house, and Misak followed behind her. Eventually, everything calmed down. Girlene called a friend, a mutual friend of her and Misak's, and I'm going to call him Jack. I don't know what his name was. He offered to come over and hang out in the afternoon with Misak so Girlene could go back to work and not get all worried. Before she left the townhouse to go back to Publix, she told Misak she wouldn't be coming home that evening because she didn't want him to push or beat her anymore. Misak responded by saying, quote, "Baby, I'm not going to do anything to you. I love you, you know? It's okay. It's all right. If I touch you, I'll go to jail, you know?" End quote.
Well, that's a weird thing to say.
Considering he just, like, beat her a couple days ago or the night before.
Don't worry, I'm not going to do anything.
Come on, baby.
Why? So she can come home, so then you can beat her.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Later that afternoon, Girlene returned home during a break from work. Do you want to check on the kids? I can't say I blame her.
I really can't blame her.
The couple got into another argument. Then she ended up going back to Publix. Later in the afternoon, Misak had to go to his job at Miller's Ale House. Jack offered to watch the children until Girlene got home. Now, Misak suggested to him, and I don't know all the details of the background of this, but it was in the court records. He said, "Hey, Jack, how about you use my Yukon," because he drove a Yukon, "to load up some music equipment, and I'll take your car to work." And Jack was like, "Okay."
And spy on Girlene.
No, yes, you're so good. Yes, of course. I was just going to say, that's not the real reason that he wanted to switch cars. He didn't want to be recognized driving by Publix. And I get a little confused. I don't know if Girlene can see him at Publix. Like, they have cameras. I don't know.
Because, like, if she was, maybe she was up front near the windows. Who knows?
Who knows? At approximately 7 p.m., Girlene arrived home from work. Jack hung around for a while afterwards, and he was just conversing with her. She was at her wit's end. She expressed concern as to what Misak might be capable of when she actually files for divorce. And again, she expressed the effect the violence was having on her children. Although Misak was at work, all he could think about was Girlene leaving him for another man, and the other man raising his kids, and him not seeing his kids.
We'll do better then.
That is a very valid point. Why don't you worry about fixing yourself you're really that concerned? He complained to his manager that he had a headache, and he asked if he could leave early. He clocked out of Miller's Ale at 8:42 p.m., and as he drove towards the townhouse, various scenarios played through his mind. Quote, "I said I would go and kill her and myself, but if I kill her, custody of the kids would go to her mom. So I wanted to kill her mom so my mom would have custody. I was talking to myself in the car. I said, what if I kill my kids and myself? But what about her? She'll marry again. What if I just kill her? but if they find me, they'll take my kids away from me, end quote. He's just trying to figure out how he can kill, who he should kill to get what he wants. Yeah, it's
so fucking terrible.
Around 9 p.m., Jack noticed his own vehicle drive past the townhouse, turn around, and leave. And he's like, I'm guessing, what the fuck?
Right.
Miss X is supposed to be at work, right? What's he doing? Jack quickly grabs the keys. He jumps into the Yukon, and he follows behind his car, flashing the vehicle lights. Miss X immediately stops the car, and Jack got out of the Yukon, and he asks Miss X, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on, man?
What the hell is wrong?
Poor friend is in the middle of all of this, right?
Exactly. Very uncomfortable situation to be in the middle of. Miss X was adamant that Girlene was running around on him with another man, and it was driving him crazy. No matter how many times Jack tried to reassure him that he was wrong, he wouldn't listen. The two men swapped vehicles, and Jack observed Miss X drive away in the opposite direction of the townhouse. At approximately 10:30 p.m. that Thursday night, Miss X walked into a Walmart where he purchased a roll of duct tape, a fillet knife, and a pack of gum. From there, he got into his Yukon and headed towards the townhouse.
Oh, Talia, I don't want to hear this.
What?
Oh, what? Man.
I'm mildly offended. Well, the good news is we're going to take a quick break. On Friday morning, this is the next day, Girlene failed to show up to her shift at Publix, which was completely out of character for her. Her family and the manager tried to reach her, but they didn't get any response. By Saturday morning, they grew so concerned that the family went to the townhouse. But when they got there, all the doors were locked and they couldn't see through the window. And of course, they're banging on the door and nobody's answering. So they immediately contact the Collier County Police Department and request that they meet them at the townhouse to perform a welfare check. The landlord was also contacted, and he showed up to help them unlock the front door. Upon entry, the officers observed a red substance that appeared to be blood leaking from the closed door of a small bathroom under the stairway. So it's got that stairway, it's kind of cool. Like, it's got a bathroom under it.
Ah, okay. Yep. I understand.
Way to utilize the space.
Yeah, for sure, right?
Believing a violent crime had been committed and the perpetrator might still be in the house, the two officers that showed up withdrew from the house and then they called for backup. I mean, Girlene's brother, who was standing outside, he immediately knew his sister was gone. He knew she was dead. Upon re-entry by the police, they opened the bathroom door and they found Girlene laying on the floor with a large area of dried blood beneath the upper part of her body. Her head was covered with a black trash bag. Underneath the bag, her neck and her mouth had been bound with duct tape. Lots and lots of duct tape. The upper half of her body was bound with so much duct tape that it was impossible to discern what she was wearing from the waist up.
Her upper body was duct taped too?
All of it. You couldn't even tell what she was wearing.
Oh my God.
Her arms were behind her back, and her wrist and hands, palms facing outward, were also wrapped extensively with duct tape. Lots of duct tape over and over. As were her legs from just above her knees to above her ankles. In all, Girlene had been wrapped in 55 yards of duct tape. I looked it up. That's a whole roll. 165 feet.
Holy shit.
50 meters. That's so much fucking duct tape.
How many yards?
55.
That's half a football field.
Wow, you're good. I'll have to defer to you on that.
I mean, it's 100 yards.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a part that got me really emotional.
So much duct tape. I can just imagine her terror, too.
Yeah, because she was alive when every single inch of that duct tape was put on her. Mm. Her torso and hands, they were also loosely wrapped with electrical cord. So it's really hard for me to imagine because I'm imagining that she's duct taped with her arms behind her back and it's all around. But he also put electrical cord around her hands and her torso because he had run out of duct tape. And obviously, he just wanted her to not be able to move at all.
Jeez.
Her cause of death was a deep cut to her throat, which he made through the duct tape.
Wow.
And I don't know when he put the bag over her head. He could have done it to minimize the blood, but I'm not sure. I don't know. Or to torture her.
Right.
With a sense of dreaded uneasiness, police proceeded to the second floor of the townhouse where the children's bedrooms were. In one bedroom, they found Mitch Sack, the 9-year-old. He was dead on his bed, his throat cut. He would never be able to join the football team that he hoped to join that fall. The knife wounds, they nearly encircled his entire neck. He had defensive wounds on him. And the bed that he laid on was broken from him struggling with his father. In the second bedroom upstairs laid the deceased bodies of the remaining DeMoss 4 children. Marvin, Maven, Morgan, and Megan. All of their throats were cut. The laceration to 5-year-old Marvin's throat was so deep that he was nearly decapitated. There were superficial defensive wounds to the 5-year-old's hands and a long cut down his face from the cheek almost to the jaw. The cut was later described by the medical examiner as an attempt to get control of the victim and get the bladed instrument into position.
Oh.
He didn't believe it was torture and he didn't believe it was like a frenzy. He was trying to position it. Noticeably absent from the home was Misak. By that Friday morning at 6:40 a.m., he'd already entered the Miami International Airport and paid cash for a one-way ticket to Port-au-Prince, Haiti. The flight departed at 9:50 a.m., and in less than 12 hours, after annihilating his family, he touched down in Haitian soil. A reward was offered by the family for his capture, and he was subsequently apprehended in Port-au-Prince within 3 days by the Haitian National Police. While he was being escorted by law enforcement, a reporter from Naples Daily News happened to be in Haiti.
Really?
Yeah. And this reporter called out to Misak, "Did you kill your family?" And he said, "Yes, I did."
Wow.
He told the reporter that he wanted to die right away because he knew his family was going to be buried really soon and he wanted to be buried next to them.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. When the reporter asked him what led him to kill his family, he said, "Only God knows." But then he made a reference to Gerline's mother, saying how she made him do it. Quote, "Her mom's spirit, whatever she's serving, whatever she worships, basically made him do it."
Mm-hmm.
Misak told the reporter that he planned on committing suicide after the killings, but didn't have the courage to do it. And he was going to turn himself in once he said goodbye to everybody in Haiti.
Sure.
Even though it had been 3 days.
Yeah.
It was a very long goodbye.
Yeah.
He ended up having 3 separate interrogations with different law enforcement. And he just spilled his guts out, told them everything, anything and everything they wanted to know. So let me tell you the gist of what he described happened on the night of the murders. After swapping vehicles with Jack, he went to Walmart, as you know. He bought the duct tape and the knife and the fucking gum.
And because he had to have minty fresh breath, I guess.
And then he drove to the townhouse community swimming pool where he parked. He then crept towards the townhouse and in around to the back. He watched Gerline through the screened-in lanai for more than an hour. And according to him, she was on her cell phone. She was laughing.
How dare her?
She looked happy. And he knew she was talking to her lover.
Right. Absolutely. God, he's so fucking nuts.
He's so far from reality. I mean, she's getting beat by her husband. She's got 5 kids. All she's probably doing is talking to family and friends about how to get out of this situation. She is not worried about any sexual pleasures at that point.
Does she really have time?
No.
I mean, honestly, she works. She's got 5 kids. She's got to deal with his crazy butt.
Yeah.
I mean, come
she's
on.
Got a stalker, man.
Yeah, exactly. She's got no time.
Doesn't he think he would have seen this guy by now?
I know. Like, every time he goes to Publix, she's there.
Surprise.
Surprise, I'm fucking at work again.
God, you're getting me all worked up,
I know.
Tanya.
I'm so irritated.
At approximately 12:30 a.m., he couldn't take anymore. You know, she's like, ha, ha, ha,
yeah.
I love you, sexy, whatever, in his mind.
I know, right?
So he tore off the screen door of a lanai and he entered the townhouse through a sliding glass door. So I'm assuming by this time she was no longer in the lanai. And he knew that that sliding glass door wasn't functioning properly, so it wouldn't have been locked. When Gerlene saw him, she screamed and she told him, "Don't you touch me." But he was just enraged and he threw his fist back and he started punching her in the face. He knew then he was going to go to jail. Like, he was beating her, and it was bad enough that he knew that she was going to report him. In fact, she was trying to get her phone, and a fight ensued in the kitchen. She couldn't get her phone, so she tried to escape the house, but then he grabbed her, and he says he pulled her by the hair back, and then he cut her throat from behind with a fillet knife. But that's not what the evidence suggests at all. Her throat wasn't cut until much, much later in the evening. So I don't know why he claims it happened that way. After beating Gerlene some more, she just fought. I mean, Tanya, she fought for her life and for her children's life. And that's why he kept just putting that duct tape around her, because she wouldn't stop struggling. Even after her whole upper body was duct taped, including her neck, and her mouth was covered, she continued to pound her feet against the wall because it was a shared wall with a neighbor. Mm. She was trying to arouse the neighbor's attention. So that's when he started binding her lower legs with the duct tape. And she still fought him. And then he says he ran out of the duct tape and he just started wrapping her more with an extension cord. According to Ms. Sack, he told her, quote, "I'm going to let you live. I won't kill you, but I'll kill all the kids in front of you. I'll let you go, but I'm going to burn the house with me and the kids in it." So wow, these are the things he's saying to her while she's just bound helpless. At one point, he said he could tell she was trying to talk, but the duct tape prohibited her from doing so. So he removed it. And then she said, "I love you so much." And I'm sure, you know, she's just doing whatever. And that made him even more angry. And he yelled out, "Why are you lying to me?" And she pleaded with him, "Just whatever you do, please just don't hurt the children." And that's so upsetting to me because given what's happening to her, her thoughts are still, just don't hurt our children. Do what you want to me. Don't hurt them. He told her, "I can't let you go because if I let you go, I'm going to be getting like 6 years in jail because I know you're going to call the cops." He then dragged her from the kitchen into the small bathroom that was under the stairway. He knew what he was about to do, and he didn't want the blood to get everywhere, which is why he said he moved her to the bathroom. And that's why I suggested perhaps that's why he put the bag around her head and neck. With a fillet knife in hand, he held up Gerlene's head by her hair, I'm assuming, because that's what he said he did earlier, and he slit her throat through the duct tape. She didn't die right away. As she lay dying, he engaged in the following thought process. Quote, "What am I going to do? Run, call the cops, say I killed my wife or something. I love my children to death. I'm going to jail for life. Death penalty, whatever, electric chair. I'm thinking. 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm thinking. I got the knife in my hand still. And I said to her, I'm going to slice my throat too. I'm going to suffer before I fucking die. I can do it," end quote. That's what he says he's telling her.
Mm-hmm.
He told the FBI agents, quote, "I wasn't going to kill the kids, man. I still had them surviving, you know, letting them live. So the devil came to me and said, who's going to take care of the kids?" End quote. That's when he proceeded upstairs where, in his own words, he cut the children's throats one by one.
We couldn't let Gerlene's mom have them.
Exactly.
This is terrible.
He first killed Megan, the 3-year-old. Afterwards, he heard a voice saying, "Good job." Misak cried out that he just couldn't continue. But the voice told him, "Yes, you can. Keep doing it." He then killed Marvin, the 5-year-old, and Maven, the 6-year-old. After that, he was adamant he couldn't go on. So he started packing for Haiti, planning to leave Misak and Morgan alive, the oldest and the youngest. However, when he proceeded downstairs, he said, quote, "I see a bunch of blood, my wife laying down. I was like, oh my God, there was blood everywhere on my feet. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my life. They're going to give me the death penalty." And then the voice said, "You got two more left. You're gonna die anyway. You're gonna leave those two behind? Her mom will probably have custody of them. I said, hell no, I don't want her mom to get custody. If I had a chance to kill her mom, I would drive there or whatever. Go to Haiti, kill her mom. And then the devil was like, well, her mom's gonna get custody of them. And I said, hell no. And then I went upstairs and I caught the little one. He said that 19-month-old Morgan was the easiest one to die. However, 9-year-old Mitchsack, who's laying on that bed, remember I told you he was laying on his bed when his dad attacked him, he put up a struggle and that's how the bed broke. Mitchsack had classic defensive injuries on his hands and he had cuts and shallow stab wounds to his shoulder from trying to repel the attack. But of course, I mean, he's no match for his father. Man.
Yeah.
After cutting his son's throat, he stood over him and watched him bleed to death. He then changed his bloody clothing. He put the knife, which was bent, in a nightstand in the master bedroom. He finished packing the suitcase, took all of Girlene's money from her wallet, and drove to the Miami airport where he got that one-way ticket to Port-au-Prince.
I thought he was going to confess. I
guess he turned himself into Haitian police. That's probably it.
Yep.
He said before he left the townhouse, he contemplated suicide yet again, but he just couldn't bring himself to cut his own throat. So instead, when he was in the car, his Yukon, he planned to drive into the path of another car, but ultimately continued to the airport.
Would kill another person?
Right?
Because you know his fucking ass would survive, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
End up killing some innocent people. Misek was adamant that he knew what he did was wrong, but Tanya... it wasn't his fault because his mother-in-law.
Oh, that's right.
Girlene's mom, she practiced voodoo, even though she didn't anymore, but I don't know, whatever. She's got that mixture of it going on. And quote, she's been voodooing my ass ever since we've been making children, end quote. That voodoo caused bad spirits to make him kill his family. He also said that some of the women that he was sleeping with were married and perhaps their spouses were putting a hex on him, some sort of black magic going on. He told authorities that a while ago when the church found out that he and Girlene were having premarital sex, he wasn't allowed to be president of the church youth group anymore. So he ended up leaving the church. And when he left the church, quote, I no longer had any protection from my God, so anything could happen to me, end quote. He also believed that one of his co-workers, who he didn't get along with, who was from a Haitian village known for its aggressive magic in the invisible world, threw a force on him and made him do horrible things to destroy his own life. But it was pretty clear through his admissions, and you pointed out, that the real driving force was to prevent his mother-in-law from raising his children. He hated her. He hated her.
Well, I'm sure she wasn't very fond of him either.
She wasn't. She wasn't going to talk to Girlene if she stayed with him. So Misak believed that he no longer had Jesus to protect him from these demonic attacks. His fear of sorcery and of evil magic played a huge role in his behavior. I mean, that's without a doubt. He really believed these things. He really believed people were sending evil spirits to attack him. And that's fine, but you have to accept personal responsibility in the end.
Yep.
It took 8 years for his trial to take place.
What?
8 years.
Was he in jail that whole time?
Yes, thank God. Can you imagine him not? Hello, no. 8 years. Mostly, it was a result of his behavior. He wouldn't cooperate. He was just extremely difficult. They went through 4 different judges and 8 different lawyers. While in jail, he went on a hunger strike in an attempt to starve the demons out of him. He also refused to bathe.
Oh, gross.
And that got to the point where people were bitching about his smell.
Yeah.
He was defiant with the guards and had been tasered on multiple occasions. So you hear all this and you're like, he must be crazy. Maybe he's mentally ill. Well, I think he kind of wanted people to believe that, but he was deemed to be competent. He was sent to the Treasure Coast Forensic Treatment Center. He was there for a couple weeks. And the psychologist who evaluated him said that, quote, he makes a conscious choice to cooperate when it suits him to do so, indicative of a person with narcissistic personality and antisocial personality disorders. He is grandiose, preoccupied with his own self-worth, entitled, and wants to be admired by others.
Mm-hmm.
He lacks empathy, and he's arrogant, as well as aggressive and deceitful.
Amen.
He requests to represent himself. Fucking asshole.
Oh, of course, because he's so smart. He's fucking narcissist.
He was denied for a number of reasons. There was a Feretta hearing. I'm not going to go into all the court stuff because obviously 8 years, there's a lot of court bullshit that I have no interest in because we deal with court bullshit all the time. But none of the reasons for denial had anything to do with his mental health, but more based on his behavior and his lack of cooperation. The judge couldn't even basically get him to say if he understood things or not. Like, he was just such an ass. He would often in court erupt into these bizarre religious rants. And sometimes he would sing Christian songs. Would you like to hear some?
Sure.
Here we go. Let's play a clip.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
You're welcome to the fall of my faith.
I'm going to see my Lord.
Whatever happens for a reason. When God knows everything about us.
Here's another clip of him just being weird and out there.
Grab Jesus and all of y'all. And I'm safe.
You can notify
I'm
everyone
safe.
To be here.
And here's another clip.
I want this thing to be done as soon as possible. You know, I don't want no trial. And then especially I don't want my family to be involved in this.
What do you want to be sentenced to? Death?
Yeah, just
death. Want to be sentenced to death?
Enough is enough. I don't want my people to keep trying, crying, you know, when they hear about this case, every time they, you know, they see it on TV.
So he goes on and he's just ranting and raving. And then at some point through the years, he simply refuses to speak at all.
The judge probably like, thank God, finally.
But it causes a problem because the judge needs to get definitive answers and he can't get it from Ms. X's attorney because Ms. X won't talk to his attorneys and he can't get it from Ms. X. So eventually the judge just assumes silence is like yes to the answers.
Yeah, it's affirmative, right?
That's exactly
Your
true.
Silence means you agree. Speak up if you don't.
No? Oh, no? Okay. Okay, exactly. He would put tissue in his ears during court. However, on September 5th in 2017, he was allowed to plead guilty to 6 counts of first-degree premeditated murder. A month later, the sentencing hearing took place. And he waived his right to present mitigating factors that might persuade the judge to impose a life sentence instead. So the judge asked him, are you sure you don't want to present mitigating factors that might make it so you're not put to death? He doesn't respond, but he does write the judge a note. It says, quote, go ahead, continue your work. May my blood be upon your shoulders. And he signed it, Child of God, C-O-G.
C-O-G?
Because he began okay. calling himself Child of God, C-O-G.
Oh, okay. Judge is like, fuck you. Like the judge gives one shit.
I'm just like, really, Child of God, really? Girlene's brother, McKindy, yeah, read a victim impact statement. Instead of reading it, I'm just going to have you listen to it. But I thought the most profound part of it was he didn't want his sister's legacy to be that of a domestic violence statistic. Instead, he wanted people to know what she was to him and his family and what she could have been to the community. And here's what he had to say.
The emotional roller coaster is over. It is finally time for the dear angels to rest in peace. Choose to remember our family for what it was and always will be. A family of love, a family of strength, a family of honor.
On October 27, 2017, the judge in the trial court imposed 6 death sentences on Misak for the murders of Girlene, Mitchak, Maven, Marvin, Megan, and Morgan.
Aww. I mean, I'm not sorry for him. I'm sorry that he murdered his fucking family.
It's so oh, people. Sad. So fucking sad.
How sad. Those poor children.
Yeah. So now you can see why I was so upset when I researched and wrote this.
Yeah.
And I got almost all of my information from the court records. I watched this poor attorney argue in appellate court all the errors that were allegedly happening. So felt so bad for the attorney.
It's like polishing that turd.
That was exactly it.
Absolutely.
So now he sits there on death row with his crazy ass.
Man.
I want to thank everybody for taking a few minutes out of your day to listen to us and also say, if you're a victim of domestic violence, you can call 1-800-799-7233. Reach out to somebody. You can text at 88788. reach out, get help. There's help out there for you.
Wow, Talia, thanks for that one. Wow, that was a real pisser.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. I got nothing to say. I'm sad.
Me too.
If you want to see some pictures from this episode, see what Gerlene and the children look like, you can go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com. Also at crimesandconsequences.com, you can learn more about our Patreon program and our Apple Podcast channel, where we have about 180 unreleased episodes to the public that are just for our members, our paid subscribers. You can also find out how to get some cool merchandise.
You can find us on social media at Hardcore True Crime on Facebook and Instagram.
Hardcore True Crime. Anything else?
No, I don't think so. And if there is...
Oh, well. Oh, well.
Oh, well. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.